WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jimmy Carter knows that as a born-again Christian president, his faith was the subject of public speculation. He writes about his faith and how it sustained him while he was president in a new collection of essays called Living Faith. He says the book is an outgrowth of the Bible classes he's been teaching ever since he became an adult. He now leads an adult class at a Baptist church in Plains, Georgia. He writes that it's become increasingly difficult to separate church and state issues, and even the purely religious issues have to be addressed by politicians. Jimmy Carter says that since leaving the White House in 1980, he's moved away from politics and toward religion. I asked him to elaborate on that.
Well, I've got more time now to devote to my church and my duties as a Christian in a non-political fashion. I just don't have any ambitions or interest in ever seeking another public office. And the Carter Center's work, in which Rosa and I devote almost all of our time, is strictly bipartisan in nature. So now I'm able to teach Sunday school every Sunday that I'm in Plains, which is about 2 out of 3 Sundays. Last year I taught 36 times. And some other aspects of our life are directly related to Christianity. But I don't want to imply that when I was president that I abandoned my faith or found a basic inconsistency between what I believe in religion and what I did as a politician. I think almost always they were compatible. There were a few times when they were not completely compatible, but I took an oath of office before God to support the Constitution and laws of my nation, and I did. And if I disagreed with some of the laws or felt that they were not completely compatible with my religious faith, I just obeyed the law.
That's an interesting way to look at it, though, that you took an oath before God to actually serve the country. And so you felt that you had it straight with your religion, that you were in this office to serve the country, and it wasn't about your personal religious convictions when it came down to certain issues. It was about what you thought was best for the country or in the majority interest.
Two or three aspects. One is that I believe in the separation of church and state.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very careful not to have religious services in the White House or to have religious meetings in the White House. I went to church on Sunday when I was in Washington at the First Baptist Church at Camp David. We had a private religious service. And there were very few times when I felt any discrepancy at all. But I had to interpret the Constitution as the Supreme Court ruled it to be at that particular moment. There were two issues, for instance, I'll just give you an example, where I felt that, I just couldn't believe that Jesus Christ would favor abortions. And I also can't believe that he would favor the death penalty. And fortunately, all the time I was governor, all the time I was president, there was never a death penalty imposed. On abortion, the Supreme Court had ruled that Roe versus Wade was applicable, and I obviously, as president, enforced that interpretation of the Constitution, but I did everything I could to reduce the need for abortions. So that was the main thing that came to mind.
While you were in the White House and while you were campaigning for president, did you feel that a lot of Americans misunderstood or misinterpreted what it meant to you to be born again?
Well, that was obvious to me because the number one news story of the entire 1976 campaign was an interview that I gave with Playboy magazine. And all I did was quote part of a Sermon on the Mount, and it became an issue that almost cost me the election. The Playboy interviewer turned off his tape recorder, started to leave my home, and he said, "You claim to be a born-again Christian. You claim to be perfect. American citizens imperfect. How can you claim to be willing to govern them fairly?" And I said, "Well, you've completely misinterpreted my religion. Our religion teaches us that all of us have sinned, come short of the glory of God, that we should not judge other people. And Jesus taught us not to try to distinguish between degrees of sinfulness. If we hate our brother, we should not criticize someone who commits murder. If we have lust in our heart for a woman, we should not criticize a person who commits adultery. And, of course, the next question was inevitable. He said, have you committed adultery? And I answered that question. He said, well, have you ever had lust in your heart? And I said, sure. When I was a high school kid, when I was in college, or before I married Rosen, quite often I would look at a beautiful girl and I would want to have sex with her. And he said, well, thanks a lot. So he left. And two or three weeks later, Playboy magazine came out. It was the biggest selling issue of Playboy in history. And my public opinion poll dropped 15% in 10 days. So that was those innocent days 20 years ago, just because I said that I, you know, had lust, as I thought everyone, every man did. But then the news reporters went all over the country asking famous preachers and TV evangelists about the issue, and they all said, no, no, I've never lusted after any woman except my wife. So it made me look, you know, both sinful and also, I would guess, equivocating on an important issue.
Your years in the White House coincided with the emergence of the religious right. Did you have many encounters with the religious right?
No, in fact, I never heard of the moral majority of the religious right until the latter stages of my campaign in 1976. They were not well known. And then it was only a couple of years after that, I believe, that Jerry Falwell, for instance, was on the front cover of Time magazine with the startling emergence of the religious right. And by the time I went out of office, they had become quite a formidable political entity. They had basically gone to bed with the conservative wing of the Republican Party. And since then, of course, they've had waxing and waning influence on the global or the American political scene. So I didn't have any unpleasant encounters with them during my campaign, but after I got to be president, I was looked upon by some of them as a non-Christian. In fact, one of the most exalted members in the Baptist faith came to the Oval Office one day, I think in 1979, with his wife. I met him. I was very proud to meet the leader of my denomination. And when he left, he said, Mr. President, we'll be praying that you abandon secular humanism as your faith and return to Christianity. I had no idea what he was talking about. And I asked a few of my friends who were theologians and experts on religion, and they tried to explain what he was talking about. The measure then was whether or not I was in favor of mandatory prayer in schools, or whether or not I was in favor of a constitutional amendment to prohibit all abortions, whether or not I was in favor of other things of that kind. One of the things they were against then was my negotiating with the Soviet Union to have a strategic arms limitation agreement. They looked upon the Panama Canal treaties as proof that I didn't measure up to their standards of Christianity, things of that kind.
Jimmy Carter is my guest, and he has a new collection of essays about faith called Living Faith. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jimmy Carter. He has a new collection of essays about faith called Living Faith. How did you approach your prayer life in the White House? You say in your book that other presidents have brought in Billy Graham to organize, worship for them, but you didn't want to do that in the White House. You thought it violated your sense of separation of church and state. So what did you do?
Well, I worshipped as I would if I had not been in public life at all. I went to Sunday services at the First Baptist Church in Washington, which was the nearest Baptist church to the White House. Most of the weekends we tried to go to Camp David. We had a chaplain from a nearby army base come and preach a sermon. We sang hymns together. And as far as my personal prayer life was concerned, I would say it was much more frequent and maybe on the average more heartfelt than ever, any other time in my life, because I felt that the decisions I made were affecting the lives of hundreds of millions of people. I never prayed for popularity. I never prayed to be reelected, things of that kind. I prayed that I could keep my nation at peace. I prayed that I could extend the advantages of peace to other people, say, between Egypt and Israel at Camp David. When the hostage crisis came along, the prayer that I made was that all the hostages would come back home safe and free, that I would not betray the principles of my nation or do anything to embarrass it. And I think in all those cases, my prayers were answered. I think God always answers our prayers. Quite often, God's answer is no. We don't get what we ask for. And then the obligation, if we have faith, is to find out within ourselves why. Are we asking for selfish things? Are we asking for things that are unjustified? Are we asking for things that ought to be granted in the future? Should we change the priorities in our lives? Are our prayers in accordance with God's will? Those are the kind of things that I've learned over a long lifetime, as you know. And those are the things I try to describe in Living Faith.
What was your sense of prayer when you were a child, and how has your sense of prayer changed as an adult?
Well, when I was a child, say when I reached the age of 10 or teenage life, I had some very serious doubts about what I heard in church, what I heard in Sunday school, what I heard my own father teaching. But I wouldn't express my doubts to anybody. And I thought I was very sinful not to have absolute and total faith. Now my faith is stronger. I can see the various aspects of a deep Christian faith. I realize that as I was at the age of 15, I'm still searching. I'm still trying to learn. I'm still trying to stretch my heart, stretch my mind. I learned two or three times in my life that my faith could sustain total doubt in God. I rejected God a few times. I felt that God had betrayed me, that I could not depend on my faith at all. And I had to go through a very difficult and unpleasant healing process. I've learned over a period of a long lifetime, 50 years of marriage with Rosalind, how sadly mistaken I was in dealing with her. When we first got married, I was an arrogant young Naval Academy graduate. Rosalind was a very shy, timid, younger person from Plains, Georgia. I totally dominated her. I didn't show any sensitivity when she was distressed. I was just impatient. When decisions were to be made about our family's life, I didn't consult with her. I just made a decision and informed her what we were going to do. And that was in my formative stage as a mature human being. I've learned to correct some of those mistakes. So prayer life for me has paralleled in awareness and growth and in significant my evolution as a human being. And I hope that I'll continue to improve in the remaining years that I have.
Tell me if this is too personal, okay? What were the times in your life that you thought God betrayed you?
Well, one of the most distressing times was in 1966. I had been a state senator two terms. I thought after prayer that I should run for governor of Georgia. I mounted a massive campaign all over the state, frantically, shaking hands, asking people to support me. My opponent was a racist named Lester Maddox, whose symbol was a pick handle that he used to beat African-Americans over the head if they tried to come into his restaurant and buy some fried chicken. When the results came in, Lester Maddox had won, and I had lost. And I couldn't believe that the Georgia people preferred him. I couldn't believe that God would let this happen. So I had a complete renunciation of my faith. And my sister, who lived in Fayetteville, North Carolina, Ruth Carter Stapleton, was a very famous evangelist. My mother called her and told her that I had this attitude. So Ruth came down to Plains. And we went out in the woods. And Ruth tried to console me, which was impossible. And Ruth quoted a couple of verses from the second chapter of James, which was a foundation of Ruth's ministry, which was a very happy ministry. Anyway, James says, according to God, that no matter how horrible a mistake we made, or how total our failure might be, or how abject our despair, or how great our loss, that if we have, first of all, courage, and then if we have patience, and then if we are wise enough to seek wisdom from God, any catastrophe can be changed into a blessing. I told Ruth that this was a complete baloney. That wasn't the word I used. That it was ridiculous. And Ruth said, Jimmy, you have to have faith that this is true. She said, why don't you just forget about politics for a while and just respond to any opportunities you have. So just a few weeks later, I was asked to go as a lay witness to Lock Haven, Pennsylvania. A group of volunteer Baptists from State College, which is where Penn State University is, had called every family in the phone book, and they had identified 100 families, none of whom had any religious faith. And I was asked to go and visit those families. So I knocked on the door. Some received us with open arms, some wouldn't open the door. And at the end of a week, I had experienced for the first time in my life a genuine presence of God, a sense that the Holy Spirit was with us. We had 48 people who accepted the Christian faith. We rented an old church building and left Lock Haven with a new church going. And that was a turning point in my life. I then began to see that no matter if I was elected to any future office or not, that there were other things in life. As the history books would say, I ran for governor again. I was elected. I went on and became president of the United States. But that's not the real point. The point is that when we do have a setback in politics or in business or whatever, we need to have faith that we can find an alternative that would give us much more significant priorities in life.
How do you think the issue of religion in the lives of public figures has changed from the years you were in the White House to now?
Well, there's no doubt that in many elections just settled in the United States this November, that the role of religion has played a major part. And now there is a blatant condemnation of any candidate who espouses any degree of abortion, a blatant condemnation of candidates who are not in favor of mandatory prayer in schools, or who condone any equal rights for homosexuals, for gays. And these are litmus tests for a candidate. If a candidate measures up to all those litmus tests and others, I would say the death penalty is another one, or the freedom of ownership of guns. They vary, of course, but those are a few that come to mind. Those are the measurements of a candidate who's acceptable among the very conservative religious organizations. So this is a new development in our country. I don't think this has ever happened before 1980. But since then, it's become quite a prevalent factor on the American political scene.
Jimmy Carter, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, I've enjoyed it.
Jimmy Carter's new book is called Living Faith. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.